In just 3 weeks, at the start of October, it's Nobel Prize time. So who do you think wrote this?
I think it's high time the Nobel Prize for Literature was awarded to a scientist. Seriously, why not a real scientist for the Literature Prize? Although, alas, he's no longer with us to receive it, who would deny that Carl Sagan's writing is of Nobel literary quality, up there with the great novelists, historians, and poets? How about Lauren Isley, Lewis Thomas, Peter Medawar, Stephen Jay Gould, Jacob Bronowski, Darcy Thompson? Whatever the merits of individual authors whom we might name, isn't science itself a worthy subject for the best writers? More than capable of inspiring great literature?
Well, that's from Richard Dawkins' latest book, Science in the Soul. And if you can have Bob Dylan win the Nobel Prize for Literature, why not a scientist? I went to see Richard Dawkins at his home in Oxford, where he's relaxed and forthright.
I'm pretty well apart from the croaky voice. I had a stroke in February of last year, and the voice is the main thing that hasn't quite recovered. I don't think I slur, but I croak.
Croaking's okay. What about writing? Is there any impediment in your flow of ideas?
Well, typing, my left hand kind of misses a bit. I keep hitting the caps lock key by mistake, and it is very irritating. But apart from that, now I can write pretty fluently.
You've been writing what now for well over 50 years and doing so with wonderful flair and imagery. How did you learn that in the first place?
Oxford has the weekly tutorial system. We have to write an essay every week. That might have something to do with it, I suppose. I've always read a lot and I love language, I love words. I'm not shy of using a big vocabulary. I sort of feel if the reader has to be driven to the dictionary, that's good for them.
Every now and then, why not?
Every now and then. If the exactly right word is a slightly unfamiliar one, use it. Because I love the English language. I'm sorry if it degenerates into smaller and smaller vocabulary.
No, but you've been writing constantly for those 50 years. Is it for you a form of therapy? In other words, some people have said, I find out what I think by writing about it.
There's a fair bit of that, yes. I think I understand things better for having to explain them to others.
One thing I found as really startling, especially with your last book, Brief Candle, which is a series of essays which start with a particular theme and then explore it, and there's some memoir in each piece. But there, your tone is wonderfully relaxed and friendly and, if you like, tolerant. Whereas it is quite well known that your use of tweets and elsewhere can often be somewhat acerbic. Are you aware of a difference between the two styles?
I think I'm always pretty gentle, actually. It is true that Twitter, with its 140-character limit, does place constraints, which sometimes means that you can't qualify in a nuanced way the way you would if you had longer time. But often, I think clarity is mistaken for threatening, for aggression. And sometimes I've been taken to be saying something aggressive, but all I'm doing is being clear, I think.
And does this make you upset that you're categorised in this way?
Yes, it does a bit. I don't mind getting flack from religious nuts, and I make fun of them, and I've done sort of, you know, reading out my hate mail, which I enjoy. I don't like it when it comes from my own side, so to speak. I don't like it when it comes from the left, comes from liberals, comes from feminists, that kind of thing. I feel misunderstood by them.
You say left. Some people have regarded you as somewhat conservative.
Well, I can't imagine why.
Let me just take one example of the kind of thing that I'm referring to in Brief Candle, and that is where you talk about your relationships with priests, if you like, and it's quite well known to those who read your books that you've got plenty of friends who happen to be clergymen, clergywomen or whatever, and you discuss ideas with them in a perfectly straightforward way, whereas you are sometimes deemed to be hostile to the church in that general sense. But they are indeed many friends in the church, have you not?
Yes, if you voice even mild criticism of religion, there are people who hear that as aggressive, and I think they're being defensive, I think they'd be threatened. They feel so much that their religion is part of their identity, that even a mild criticism hits home in a way that it wouldn't if you disagreed with them on musical taste or sports team or something like that.
One of your essays is about being a don, which you've enjoyed immensely over the years, and being a senior don at New College, which of course is an old college, this being Oxford, you are often called upon to say grace, and you don't mind that at all. Why not?
Well, as in the book, I think I quote Freddie Eyre, the great philosopher, who said, "I will not utter falsehoods, but I have no objection to uttering meaningless statements." So I don't have a problem with that at all. I think I also quoted Sidney Brenner. I was once dining in King's College, Cambridge, and Sidney turned to his neighbour. Sidney was the presiding senior fellow. He turned to his neighbour and said, "Dr. So-and-so, will you please say grace?" He made a point of saying that he wasn't going to do it. There was another don in New College, Geoffrey de St. Croix. He was an ancient history don, who wouldn't say grace. And he also went around and made sure somebody else would do it. He did his duty that way, but he wasn't going to say grace himself. He, by the way, I rather liked his lifelong quest to discover whether St. Paul or Plato was the greatest shit of all time.
I've heard of St. Paul being something of a shit, but not Plato. Why Plato?
Oh, I think it's his politics, probably.
Oh, I see, yes. Of course, Bertrand Russell, I think, when he was writing about the history of Western philosophy, said he was going to describe Plato in a straightforward way as if a modern fascist.
Yes, right. I think that's the point.
Which is extraordinary. What are you writing at the moment?
Well, I've just started writing what may be a children's version of The God Delusion, but I've done one chapter so far.
And what sort of line would you take for children?
Well, pretty much the same as The God Delusion, but in a way for children.
How much since you published The God Delusion a few years ago has the situation changed? In other words, is there a move towards a more secular society, in your opinion, here in Britain?
Yes, I think if you look at the figures, if you look at polls, it's quite clear that we're moving in the right direction. Even America's moving in the right direction, actually, if you look at polls. I mean, it's a long way behind, but it is moving in the right direction. Something like 25% of Americans, when polled, say they don't subscribe to any religion, which is a large number. That's a number comparable to any individual religious sect like Roman Catholics.
So how do you account for the politics of the day?
Well, it's a difficult question. I think a lot of people in America, it's not religion. I mean, Trump appeals to the religious right and got their vote, but I think that's not why he was elected. I rather favour Michael Moore's analysis that it's sort of rust belt, white working class, feeling left behind, feeling threatened. Also, the fact that he didn't win the popular vote anywhere near, it was an effect of the ludicrous electoral college system that America has, partly.
Michael Moore, of course, the filmmaker, the one who did predict that Trump would win because he understood the situation.
Yes, he's one of the very few people who got it right.
Let me ask you finally about the presence of religion in communities throughout the world. It's been suggested that most communities, way back when you didn't understand the meaning of life or the presence of death, you obviously had a spirituality that made you guess perhaps what the answers were. But it was perfectly clear that certain people, mainly the shamans or whatever, could put up a symbol and therefore help groups follow that symbol. And you know, it's a way of getting people into line so that they could create cities and, you know, live together in all sorts of ways. There is a mechanism to make you want to follow. Has it been properly understood what the nature of that mechanism might be?
Well, that's very interesting. I've been reading the works of Yuval Noah Harari, who takes very much that line, and he uses the word religion to include not just supernatural religion, which is what I do, but to include things like capitalism and liberalism and science, and so anything really that gathers people together as a symbol that they can follow, that gives them a kind of group identity. And I think that's what you're alluding to, that kind of thing. My quarrel is with supernaturalism. And so if somebody wants to use the word religion to mean something else, that's up to them. Words are our servants, not our masters. But I'm hostile to supernaturalism of all kinds. And I'm benignly curious about the idea that we need some sort of symbol to follow to give us a group identity.
I once asked you at the Sydney Writers' Festival, when you'd published God Delusion, what it would make you to chuck a Yui and perhaps a piece of evidence that would make you change your mind about this. Has anything come across recently?
No, not at all, no. I even think now it's hard to imagine what could.